Greetings, everyone, and welcome to the Yogic Studies podcast. I'm your host, Seth Powell, and this is episode 16. Just want to wish everyone a happy holidays right now. We just celebrated the winter solstice, got Christmas coming up in a couple days, Hanukkah just finished. Just want to wish everyone well right now. I know it's a very challenging and unusual winter and holiday season, and I hope in some small minuscule way, these conversations can provide a little bit of comfort, some light, and inspiration for you during this time. Today's episode is with Daniel Simpson, who's the author of a new book, The Truth of Yoga. This is part of a series I'm doing with interviews with authors and scholars of new books in the field of yoga studies. And so I was very happy to have Daniel on the podcast, and I hope that you enjoy this episode. Daniel Simpson teaches courses on yoga history and philosophy at the Oxford Center for Hindu Studies and on teacher trainings at Tri Yoga in London. He earned a master's degree in traditions of yoga and meditation at SOAS, University of London, where he had the good fortune to study with some of the leading researchers in the field. He previously worked as a foreign correspondent, initially for Reuters, then the New York Times, after studying at Cambridge as an undergraduate. His interest in yoga developed in parallel, including frequent trips to India since the 1990s. Daniel's new book, the full title of which is The Truth of Yoga, A Comprehensive Guide to Yoga's History, Texts, Philosophy, and Practices, will be published on January 5th, 2021 by North Point Press. All right, without further ado, please join me in welcoming Daniel Simpson. All right. I am joined here today by Daniel Simpson. Daniel, welcome to the Yogic Studies podcast. It's really a pleasure to have you here.
Thank you, Seth. It's a pleasure to be with you.
Yeah, it's a Monday morning here in Northern California. And where are you tuning in from, Daniel?
I'm kind of in the middle of nowhere, northwest of Oxford. So the north of the Cotswolds, for anyone who knows this part of the world. It's now evening on a very rainy day, so I'm hibernating, basically.
Yeah, well, we're all doing quite a bit of hibernating these days, aren't we? We were just saying a little bit before we started recording. Kind of give us a little snapshot of how it's going over there in your area. Is everybody pretty closed off, or are businesses shutting down again? Is this kind of a second wave over there like we have here in California?
I really don't know how many waves we're on to now, but you know, where I live, there's not a lot to close. There's the village co-op, and that'll stay open selling food. But yeah, everywhere else, you know, London, where I would normally be going, you know, a couple times a week for work, is now totally off limits. You're not allowed to enter the place unless you've got, you know, very good justification. So I think the country is, you know, I guess confused, really. We've had so many changes of rules, and to be honest, not the best leadership. So it's a difficult time. A lot of people making, you know, very sudden adjustments to Christmas plans. I was going to go and see my parents for a few days. Now that's going to be a couple hours if I'm lucky, if they don't change the rules before Friday. We'll see.
Yeah. Yeah. I wish I could understand what it's like to not have clear leadership from the top. And
it must be a real stretch of imagination for you, the last 4 years over there.
That's right. That's right. And lack of clarity about information. And it's been nothing short of chaos and just playing defense, you know, always a few steps behind, and things, policies keep changing. And likewise, we've had Christmas plans, holiday plans that have to keep being canceled and changing. And it's a very challenging, stressful time all around, but it's also been a very good time to hibernate, as you say, and to write, to do online courses, and to write books.
It's a great time to be into yoga philosophy, let's be honest. I mean, if this stuff is of any practical value, it better come out now and prove itself. Otherwise, you know, there's not much to be said for it. And I think that's been the great joy for me this year, is seeing, you know, both in terms of my own life, it's helped me ride some waves. I've had quite a few, and also just to find new ways of connecting with people online, and seeing how you know, things that I was skeptical about in the past, you know, digital ways of coming together can really forge community. And so, you know, it makes me excited about the future in some ways, despite, you know, obviously my desire to get back in a room with other human beings.
Absolutely. I mean, that's been the experience and the case here at Yogic Studies this past year. I mean, we've had a huge upsurge in people joining online courses, and the sense of community and the sentiments that we've received from people saying how these courses have got them through a really tough time. And that's been incredibly gratifying to be able to create those spaces and to be able to offer that to people. And So Daniel, you know, we've kind of crossed paths over the years. We've kind of, I don't know, danced around one another at workshops and conferences.
I remember one in particular. So go ahead. Yeah.
This might be like our first official meeting though, together.
I was about to say, yeah, you know, I remember, it must be about 3 years ago. It must have been in Boston at the AAR conference. And, you know, you came up and said, let's have a coffee. And I was running around like a headless chicken. I just lost my scarf and it was freezing outside. And I was trying to locate it. And by the time I did, then I couldn't find you again. And, three years have gone by, but, we're finally getting that chat.
That's right. Yeah. And a lot has transpired since then, no doubt. And including for you most recently, the writing launch of this book, The Truth of Yoga. So first off, just congratulations on the book. When does it come out?
Imminently. Perhaps even already before this goes to air, depending on how quickly it comes out. The start of January 2021.
So, oh, good.
It's been a long process in a way. I guess I started the project way back then when I met you. That was when I first had the idea. I was flirting with applying to PhD programs, and in the end, I threw my energies into this, but also had other things to do. So it took a while to get it out. As I guess you discover when you write a dissertation, you know, the best of intentions always have other things coming along and just sort of getting in the way of them.
Yes, definitely. That is the case, including launching online platforms and business.
Raising a family, other such minor distractions.
A family, a podcast. A number of distractions can come in the way unless we really safeguard that time and focus our attention, which I think is what's required to write a book such as this or to produce a dissertation or anything. You really do have to, you know, have this ekagrata, this kind of single focus on it, don't you?
I would agree. Yeah. Somebody once said to me, yeah, a lot of people can start projects, but it takes a certain kind of mindset to finish them. And I've definitely seen that in my life. And my hard drive probably has about half a dozen books that I've started over the years. And thankfully, I saw this one through. I guess the intention behind it was clear enough that you know, it could carry itself forward. Because in the end, I think books write us to a certain extent. They're sort of begging to come out, and that's what enables them to be shaped. I found when I'm trying to wrestle ideas into a book form, if they haven't been speaking to me, if I'm trying to summon them forth, they don't quite behave the way I'd like them to. So this one definitely had a mind of its own.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of truth in there that, you know, I get book ideas all the time, but do, you know, when do you actually have the focus and time and determination to see them through? So I want to talk to you a little bit about that more, your writing process and how this actually came to be words on a page. But before we get there, just tell us a little bit more just about how the book project came together. And by way of doing so, maybe just give us a little bit of your background and your story of how you came to yoga. And I believe you did the MA program at SOAS, which kind of got you into the research and academia side.
Correct. So,
Tell us a little bit about your story and then how that kind of gave birth to this book project.
Well, I guess it's quite similar to yours. You know, I was a practitioner. I was interested in making sense of what it was I was doing. I listened to your recent podcast with Mark Singleton, and, you know, obviously he was sharing that had been his experience as well. And being of a certain mindset, you know, he was drawn to study. And like you, I read his book, Yoga Body, and it really just opened my mind to a whole new way of engaging with the questions I had about what it was I was doing. I didn't really know where to look for answers, to be honest. Thinking back now, 15 years or so ago, when I was starting out as a yoga practitioner, I'd already had a career as a foreign correspondent that had gone rather off the rails, and getting into yoga practice had helped me get grounded. And I really wanted to understand what it was all about. I suppose I could tell it was doing me good, but apart from this sort of general wellness language around modern yoga, I didn't really have anything to hold on to. And when I started looking at old texts like the Yoga Sutra or the Bhagavad Gita, they were clearly, as everybody finds out, not really describing what it was we were doing in a modern postural yoga class. And yet at the same time, they seemed to have some relevance. And I just wanted some help to bridge that gap. And I wasn't sure where to turn. And I guess over the years, I spent quite a lot of time in India and got a lot of traditional explanations, but I always felt like I was being presented one point of view or shown just one part of the picture. And I guess what turned me onto scholarship was the idea that one could even be skeptical of the whole picture and start again and try and, with a very detached perspective, build up a completely different picture in a way that's made of the same material, but with slightly different questions and priorities. And over the years, I've come to sort of, I guess, feel that that's not my path. I've got enormous respect for yoga scholars, and I couldn't have written my book without the work that they do. But I guess my mindset has shifted more back to the practitioner, and I guess I want to use what I've learned from dipping my toes into yoga scholarship and understanding the value of skeptical engagement and critical analysis, really, of some of these stories that one gets told that don't necessarily have evidence to support them. And at the same time, really come back to my main priority of making, spiritual wisdom accessible, really. I mean, that's where these texts have come from. They're texts about the pursuit of liberation from suffering. It is not a small matter. And I think that's why people want to study them, because suffering is endemic to being alive to a certain extent, as various people much wiser than me have said. And I'm interested in how to try and, authentically, I guess, relate some of those insights to modern priorities. And those are not the same as the priorities with which the texts were written. So I guess we need to do two things. First, clarify what's in the text. Second, clarify our priorities. And then see how we're going to do some translation and be honest about that. And that's what my book's trying to do. It's an attempt to summarize what's in the major texts that have influenced yoga practice and some of the other factors that have shaped the evolution of yoga as it's changed, and then really to present them as sort of building blocks that have been assembled into different structures over the centuries, and to invite anyone who's reading to feel, in a way that we're free to do the same thing ourselves. No one's going to take, the Yoga Sutra and, some might, but it would be an ambitious one who's going to try and follow that through to Kaivalya. So we're inevitably taking some parts and leaving others behind. And so I just think, it's good to remind people that's okay, but at the same time, to also suggest that it's perhaps not okay to change what Patanjali says, call it what Patanjali says, and confuse people with that, which some yoga books have done over the last few decades.
Certainly. So you mentioned your background as a foreign correspondent, and
indeed,
you were a journalist for many years. And so it seems to me your background as a writer, you have some professional training as a writer before you, was that before you even discovered yoga and this research?
I guess they kind of went hand in hand. I remember going to India for the first time in 1998, and at that time I had just been accepted onto the graduate trainee program at Reuters News Agency. So I was a sort of foreign correspondent in waiting, and I went off for a 3-month adventure in the Himalayas. And at the start of that trip, I bought Iyengar's Light on Yoga. I'd never actually practiced any physical yoga at that point. I'd made some fairly futile attempts to teach myself to meditate, and I found myself hanging out in various places in which yoga was surrounding me, but I didn't really know what it was. As in, there were some people teaching postural yoga classes on the one hand, and there were also these strange semi-naked characters with dreadlocks sitting around fires who I found myself hanging out with, and people talked about yoga in that context too. And so it was a strange word that seemed to have something to do with this renouncer tradition that was still alive in front of my eyes. Also, you know, it was part of this foreign backpacker stretching scene with other people teaching five rhythms dance and Tai Chi and goodness knows what else. And so I dabbled a little bit, but I didn't really know how to make any sense of it. And to be honest, at that time, I probably had more fun sitting around the fire smoking dope with the sadhus. So I thought that was yoga. It took me a good half dozen years to realize I was mistaken, the expanded consciousness that I was feeling was really just getting high rather than making some sort of spiritual progress. So later I ended up in a postural yoga class, I guess, trying to reconcile these things. But at that time, in the middle of that, sorry, just to go back to your original question, I'd been working abroad. I'd been in a stressful job. I'd had this interest in India, and it had been a very life-changing experience. I then went back a couple of times to do more of the same. I went to the Kumbh Mela in 2001, spent a couple of weeks sitting around fires and I guess getting a more of an understanding of this living tradition of renunciate practice, and watching these orders of sadhus go about their holy baths, and yet at the same time not really knowing how to integrate that into my life. I was enjoying what I was learning, but it didn't have any framework for me. And that's, I suppose, later what I was trying to reconcile, that I'd seen something more than either yoga classes or ancient texts. I'd seen some living, breathing embodiment of something that was totally other. And that meant a lot more to me than everything I've been doing as a reporter, which was, it's a whole other story, but it was quite eye-opening in other ways. It got quite disillusioning at one point. I was working for the New York Times when they were basically enabling the invasion of Iraq, and I kind of just decided that was enough and resigned. And that was really what led to a journey that took me into a yoga class and brought all these strands back together.
Mm, wow. Well, amazing to have that kind of clarity to redirect your life, which brought you to India, which brought you to yoga and to the Yogic Studies podcast, of course.
I'll be honest, Seth, I took so many wrong turns, I ended up in the right direction. But
Of course, it's a windy journey, this life. There's a number of threads I wanted to pick up on and what you were saying, but what kind of initially brought me to ask you about your background in journalism and reporting is, I think the first time I had encountered you is I read an article, I think this was something you wrote, tell me if I'm wrong, I think it was from Yoga International, and it was an article talking about China as the next yoga superpower.
That's right. Yeah, it's about 10 years ago now, I think. Yeah. 2011. Yeah.
And I actually quoted this article in my MA thesis, which was about kind of authenticity of yoga and yoga as a religion or not in the American context, in particular in California, looking at the Encinitas yoga.
I remember reading about that. Yeah.
And, but this article, when I was doing that research, for that MA thesis, it's always stuck with me what you wrote in that article. And I've always wanted to ask you about it actually. And, it was something like, or what stuck with me from it, was you were looking at, you know, the rising numbers of yoga practitioners, yoga teachers in China, but that wasn't what struck me. Was, oh, wow, look how many people are practicing in China. Something more subtle was going on that you picked up on, which was that when teachers were coming to China, even from India, you had Indian yoga teachers coming to China. The Chinese yoga practitioners were asking them, who did you study with in the United States?
Yeah.
What yoga source and tradition are you drawing from? That is, they were locating the source of an authentic modern postural yoga, let's say, but in their minds, just the source of yoga, not in India, not in the Himalayas, not in those, duni fires of the sadhus, but the yoga that they had come to know and love they recognize the great teachers of that, the big names coming from America. And they wanted to know, even of the Indian yoga teachers, who did you study with in the States? Am I remembering that correctly from
there was definitely a lot of that, I guess, confusion, let's be honest, about the origins of things. And obviously the representation of yoga on the global stage has, in the last 50 years, kind of been dominated by Westerners, although there are certain Indian teachers, if you're in the know, who leap out of the woodwork. So as people were getting into yoga, those were the images they were confronted with, whether it was through DVDs or looking online or even books about yoga practice. The context in which I was in China, I went there to cover a visit by BKS Iyengar. He had been invited by Chinese authorities as kind of a diplomatic stunt in some ways, build bridges between these two powers who've repeatedly got close to going to war and seem to be a little bit near that again. And I guess it was, from the Chinese side, a way of trying to suggest that there were parallels between yoga practice and Tai Chi, and that there were perhaps also, therefore, things to be learned from going to India, and that people who were getting into yoga in a big way in China could perhaps be encouraged to go and study in India. And as a result of this visit, a lot of people got into Iyengar yoga in China. I know several senior Iyengar characters of various kinds. One very influential senior student of Mr. Iyengar's, Faik Birya, became involved in training teachers in Beijing. And then there were some other very advanced Chinese practitioners who spent a lot of time in India. And slowly, groups of Chinese started to come. I spent quite a lot of time in Rishikesh around that time, and large groups of Chinese would come and spend a week, 2 weeks there with a translator taking a class with a senior Iyengar teacher. A lot of them went to Pune, and even bigger groups doing the same thing. And so I think there was a conscious effort to try and steer that process. But attending this thing, it was just like an attempt to make a meeting where one didn't quite occur. I remember Mr. Iyengar sitting on stage, and it's a very impressive figure in many ways, but he seemed to just be disparaging this display of Tai Chi that was put on for his benefit, and suggesting that it couldn't quite capture what the Indian yoga tradition could offer. And I think he often had a story he would tell about things that involved movements couldn't quite lead to the same clarity that his precision of teaching could. And I just remember that jarring with me a bit. It was the point at which I was starting to question my, at that time, quite close involvement with the Iyengar yoga world. And
did you have a personal relationship with Iyengar? Did you study with him directly?
On that trip, there was a several day workshop that he sort of facilitated with a dozen senior teachers, a number of them from the US. If I'm trying to remember who was there, I think Manusa Manos and Patricia Walden. I think Manusa was there. I don't know if I've remembered that correctly, but anyway, there were lots of these characters around, and I had studied with some senior Western teachers. At that time, I'd wanted to go and study in India, but you had to log a certain number of years of Iyengar practice and then wait your turn for your appointment. So I'd gone there just because I didn't know if I would get to Pune before Mr. Iyengar died. I was curious to meet him. So I guess I resurrected my journalism career to find a way of paying for the plane ticket, and very fortunately managed to sell that story. And it ended up not being a story about Iyengar at all. It was about this scene that I discovered when I rocked up in Guangzhou, and there's all these yoga practitioners, and it's like a wild west of yoga. There's this sports hall with 1,300 people in it, and outside there was all these stalls selling very strange products, like yoga mats that were fluffy and a bit slippery, a bit like a sort of an oily substance used to make things for scrubbing your car windscreen or whatever. It was very, very, very odd combinations of things, and yet there was this enormous enthusiasm, and I could see very clearly that somehow this was booming, and that was a much more interesting thing to talk about, and so I used that scene of him coming there to have this sort of dialogue as a way of actually seeing that China was going to overtake the United States in terms of the number of people practicing yoga, and could potentially be, you know, a bigger influence on the way that yoga was perceived around the world 20, 30 years hence.
Do we have any sense of, is there decent demographics that we have about yoga in China today?
Very good question. I mean, I don't think we do necessarily. I mean, somebody must be collating that information. There was a Chinese edition of Yoga Journal that went through a couple of incarnations. I don't know whether they've done the same sort of research that Yoga Journal has funded in the US. Evidently, they will have done some market research, but I think it's a lot of guessing was going on. It's an enormous country, and these things are very difficult to quantify, although the government must keep tabs on it quite closely, because I think initially they were worried about yoga, having seen what had happened with things like Falun Gong, opportunities for people to gather together under this sort of spiritual pretext and be viewed with suspicion as potentially subversive. And
right.
It seemed that yoga was being promoted because it didn't seem to have that effect. And again, that was another jarring thing for me, I suppose. At that time, I was very activist minded. My flirtation with foreign corresponding and the way it had all ended, it basically radicalized me. I'd become an activist. I was very anti-war, very anti-capitalist, and strongly of the belief that yoga practice could somehow support these tendencies. And to hear that the Chinese found it so tame and unthreatening that they were happy to promote it was again quite disappointing to me at that stage. But it did seem that way. It wasn't viewed with the same suspicion, and could be allied, I suppose, with a Confucian idea of social harmony, keeping everybody sort of in good close interrelations. This sort of interconnectedness idea that sometimes we find in Western New Age presentations of yoga. So it was all round.
And that is interesting. I hadn't thought of it from the kind of nationalist or political angle of this notion that, well, it would be more convenient if yoga came from the United States rather than India, its key competitor. And so if a more secularized, fitness-oriented yoga that didn't have the religious connotations of, say, Hinduism, if that would be much more palatable in China, I would imagine.
That's correct, yes. And at the same time, obviously, take someone like Iyengar. I mean, he was teaching Indian cricket players. He's very well known as somebody who's making physical yoga accessible and not talking too much about philosophy. And that was the condition on which he was really sponsored to teach by the local authorities in the United Kingdom in the 1960s. He was allowed really to do what he did on the condition that he promised not to teach yoga philosophy. So although he talked more in later life about it, I guess in some ways he was a good choice. They didn't go for Ramdev or somebody of that stripe.
My wife and I, we spent a semester teaching English in China in 2010-11,
around that time then.
And it was a pretty remote area of northeast China, Shaanxi, very minimal English spoken, if any, really, in the area. Very, very difficult and challenging for us to navigate as foreigners. Remarkable experience all around. But we will always remember this, that just in this little town where we lived, there was a fitness center, and we discovered they taught yoga classes there, and it kind of became our little Chinese yoga studio. And these really interesting cultural experiences in this fitness center with all the mirrors set up, and all of these Chinese housewives who were doing yoga. And they had a couple different styles and sources. Some of them were doing Bikram, hot yoga. One of the teachers seemed to be drawing on A.G. Mohan's style of yoga, which was very interesting. And I learned that he had a lot of influence of coming to China. But the enthusiasm for it was just really interesting to behold. But it also kind of struck us that despite our language barriers, there was a certain universal language to these postures of modern yoga that we could kind of all participate in. And so that's something I had always thought about too, how the postures themselves across culture, this is something that is become more pronounced as yoga is modernized and globalized, that you can step into a studio in Shanghai or in, you know, in Paris, in London, in California, and you can kind of experience that same sort of thing.
Absolutely, yeah. I think in some ways, as a practitioner, I found that enormously empowering. I used to travel a lot for work, I mean, both as a foreign correspondent initially, but then the various things I did to make ends meet before I found a way to to study yoga and turn that into my job. I've always taken advantage of the fact that I like to travel. I can find things out at short notice, and I would rock up in these strange cities and want to take a yoga class, and I wouldn't necessarily speak the language, and I still found I could follow along. I mean, especially when it was in the Iyengar method where I started out, you know, I was so used to this blizzard of instructions that gets translated into different languages that even if I couldn't get the vocabulary, I had some sense of what would be expected of me. So I could put on a show of following what was being said. But I've been really impressed with the dedication of some of the Chinese students I saw over the time I spent in India. And a lot of it actually revealed itself in postural performance. I remember one of the teachers I studied with in Northern India, a Swiss woman who goes by the name Usha Devi, she sometimes cracked jokes, you know, saying that they had particularly malleable bodies and therefore, you know, we're a step ahead and we shouldn't think that just because they could make these shapes well, some of the young, you know, very bendy women who were coming into the class.
Usha Devi, she's in Rishikesh, is that right?
She is, yes. Yeah,
I took a class with her once.
She's right, quite strict.
Right on the river there, right?
Exactly,
yeah.
But at the same time, I've seen the sort of the use of that Iyengar method to discipline large groups of these people. I mean, I've seen teacher training photographs of, you know, 400 people in a graduating class, and it's like a sort of Nuremberg rally of postural yoga. Everybody making these angular shapes to perfection, all dressed in, you know, regulation bloomers and little t-shirts. But it's pretty impressive. They've mastered this stuff, and the guy Faik Birya, who was initially involved in a lot of the teacher training there. He's a pretty hard taskmaster. Makes Usha look quite mellow in some ways. So it's really interesting to see that, you know, if people really go for that, that it can be mastered quite quickly, and that can percolate quite fast through the population. And so I think that was the idea of that visit from Iyengar's side. It was he was going to be, you know, the first one to open his shop over there, and it seems to have worked to a certain extent. I mean, I haven't kept tabs over the last 10 years how many people are into what style of yoga. I've no idea, to be honest. But actually, in terms, as you say, of the postures being their own language, they're a way in, aren't they? And they are now a sort of universalized way in to something that can go in many different directions, from toning your body to look good naked to studying all sorts of life-changing perspectives on things.
that is the range, isn't it?
Right? It does seem so.
So Daniel, today, you know, as we're talking, there's just tens of millions of practitioners. Who knows really what the actual number is of people who would self-identify as someone who practices yoga today, from China to Brazil to the Philippines, the UK, United States, you name it. You know, I don't think you can really throw a dart on the map anywhere and not find a yoga shala somewhere today. So all of these people doing this thing called yoga, your book is called The Truth of Yoga. So what is the truth of yoga? And then how did you settle on the title for a book like this?
Well, there's a scholarly answer, and there's a practical answer, really. I mean, the scholarly answer is that there is no single truth of yoga. Obviously, there are so many different approaches to yoga, definitions of yoga, expressions of yoga, that to try and lump them all together as one coherent whole is not, strictly speaking, possible. And yet, from a practical point of view, I think it is possible to a certain extent to talk about something that they have in common, and they're really revealing, ultimately, we're not what we think. And there is a process by which we confuse ourselves, and there is therefore a means by which we can undo that. And I think that's the ultimate truth of yoga. There is some respite from suffering, and it consists of seeing beyond an attachment to our ideas of who we are. But yeah, ultimately, though, from the point of view of writing the book, I suppose, again, there's the honest answer, and there's the sort of more highfalutin one. I was looking for a title that really said very clearly what it was I was trying to do, which was to summarize as far as I could everything I've been exposed to in the previous couple of decades. And I didn't want it to be unambitious. I mean, I really set myself the goal of trying to summarize everything I'd learned. Mm. And that's obviously a fool's errand to a certain extent, but I had as good a go as I can. And therefore, I felt it deserved that sort of wide-ranging title. The other sort of more honest answer is that while I was writing it, I had the working title in my mind of Yoga Without the Bullshit. And this seemed the more palatable way of turning that concept around, because it did seem to me that the yoga traditions have got, you know, their own histories and texts and practices associated with them. And a lot of what we see in modern yoga in the West is taking that and blending it with other things that don't really have that much to do with yoga, whether it's, you know, I don't know, I can name any number of new age philosophies that get grafted onto the practice of yoga. But I guess I wanted to sort of strip all that away and say, well, what's actually yogic as opposed to stuff that people like to talk about in the realm of wellness and self-improvement? And so I've tried to zero in on those things. So to say this is what the yoga traditions say about finding the truth that will set us free.
You mentioned that this is an ambitious book, and it is in terms of the scope, chronologically, the time period that is covered in a book like this, as well as trying to take inventory, stock of all of the exciting and really pioneering research that's come out, especially from the Hatha Yoga Project, and trying to synthesize some of that. So tell us a little bit about, you know, who is this book written for? What do you see as the intended audience or reader for this book?
Well, I've tried to make it as accessible as possible. So I've covered, as you say, chronologically a huge sweep, and conceptually as well. I mean, it goes from the earliest recorded history to the present day, effectively. And that's broken down into roughly 100 chapters of not much more than 500 words. So they're little blog length articles on the various themes that in all sorts of different ways have been combined to make the different traditions of yoga. And therefore, I suppose I've written it for somebody like myself a few years ago who is a practitioner or a teacher of yoga who wants to have some reliable information to anchor themselves in while perhaps then going on to explore more deeply any of these particular paths. So whether it's reading one of the texts in its entirety, whether it's immersing themselves in a particular philosophical perspective, whether it's even studying with a particular lineage, it's a sort of bridge building exercise from that point of view to be an entry point. So I guess it's aimed at practitioners and teachers who want to inquire a little more and aren't quite sure where to look. They've read enough to know that they'd like to read more, but scholarly books are a little bit daunting. So hopefully this can serve as a bridge to being able to delve into the vast amount of now open access, publicly available scholarly literature that is hard to navigate if you've not read that much around the topics, because it assumes a lot of knowledge and there's a whole load of information included there that most people don't need to engage with. It's there for the purposes of scholarship, really, rather than general readership. So I've tried to comb out a few of those nuggets that will make it a little bit easier to have some handholds. So in a sense, it'd be like, I guess I see it as a way of helping people up the mountain rather than just giving them a map and pointing them in the direction and saying, off you go, which is, I guess the experience I've had when I've suggested to some of the people I teach that they read scholarly articles, they end up coming back saying, could we maybe gather together and have a little discussion group so that we know what on earth we're supposed to be getting from this? Because it's heavy going. So I guess I found that out myself, you know. It's, to go back to one of your earlier questions, I didn't really answer in full. After my time studying in India a lot, I really wanted to integrate all these different bits and pieces I'd picked up. And that's why I applied to the master's program at SOAS. Mm-hmm. And spent, you know, I was very fortunate, spent a couple of years studying with some of these pioneering researchers we've been alluding to. The team at the Hatha Yoga Project, Jim Mallinson was there teaching at that time. He just assembled the team, got the research grant together. So I was fortunate to glean all these insights. Yeah.
He was actually teaching.
He taught a whole semester of, you know, yoga history. And so I also did a year of Sanskrit with him. I was really lucky. And I guess from that time, I had the sense that there's so much here that needs to be more widely known. And now, you know, through projects such as yours, obviously it is filtering out in more accessible ways. And it's really heartening in a way to see the authors of some of the articles that are difficult to make sense of, putting together a four-part course to do exactly what I was saying, you know, is a helpful process, making that more accessible, providing some handholds, bringing it to life for people so that they do feel empowered to go and read on for themselves. And it's great. Everything's opening up. And you know, as time goes forward, more and more so. But still, people always come and say, what's the one book I should read if I really want to understand yoga history and philosophy? And I don't have an answer for them. So I decided to write it. And therefore, you know, I mean, if I'm totally honest, I would hope, you know, people who run yoga teacher trainings assign it as a good place to start. Mm. I mean, I've drawn on lots of other people's work, I've referenced it, and if anybody wants to go deeper in any direction, there are some suggested texts to work with. But if you're just looking to read an overview, make sure you've got, you know, the basics covered, I think that's what it does. That was its initial objective, to just be a map to the territory so that people can then go off exploring.
Yeah, well, I think the book definitely does fill an important gap in addressing what you're talking about, this gap between, you know, a yoga practitioner or teacher who's maybe just starting out and is intellectually or spiritually curious in some of the deeper history and philosophical roots of yoga in India, but picking up a book maybe like Roots of Yoga by Mallinson and Singleton is a bit daunting or intimidating.
Well, exactly. No, I mean, to be totally honest, that's where it began for me. It was, I got my copy of Roots of Yoga. In fact, that time we met in Boston, I'd just been with Jim and Mark at a launch they did in New York, and I'd been on stage and sort of hosted the evening for them. And yeah, it was great. They were talking really, you know, enthusiastically and openly in a way that really brought it all to life. And I remember, I mean, I'd found the book really engaging because I'd been exposed to a lot of the material in it while I was studying. And I was recommending it to people right, left and center. And they kept saying that they found it hard work to read. Yeah. And I felt that was a real shame. And in the end, it is more of a reference book than a book people are going to read cover to cover, unless they're, like me, a proper yoga nerd. So I guess, you know, I wanted to provide something that would make it more likely that people would want to read a book like that. And over the years, I've also done, you know, I've hosted book clubs. So we ran one earlier this year on Roots of Yoga where, you know, over a dozen weeks, we worked our way chapter by chapter through it. And I think people gained the confidence to see that it isn't as daunting as they think. It just needs breaking down into smaller parts. So you're just reading one part of the chapter and the relevant source material that goes with it, and then making a little presentation to the group, then that's, you know, it's really empowering for people. And they start to see it is possible to engage with, but, you know, picking it up at first, as you say, it's a lot to take on if that's the first book you've opened, other than a couple of you know, lighter titles, shall we say.
Definitely. And I think, you know, Roots of Yoga, it's a very specific type of book. As you said, it's more of a reference work. The intro chapters, you know, in Roots of Yoga to the chapters on different methods or, you know, yogic ideas, asana, mudra, the yogic body, and so forth, they're incredible, dense, you know, snapshots of what we can say or could say at the time that this was written based on the research at the time. But the whole book itself doesn't kind of read as a, you know, beginning, middle, and end. It doesn't have the same kind of narrative or, you know, chronology of kind of a history book, or even, you know, a book like yours that really kind of goes from the earliest period, you know, early ancient yoga, its roots, and then kind of weaving together a narrative all the way to present day. So roots of yoga, you know, as you're saying, I think for people who just don't have as much of a background, it's difficult. You're also, when you're reading the translations, you're often missing the context of each of those larger texts and the traditions in which those texts, you know, are situated within. And so when you're just reading selections of you know, descriptions of asana or pranayama from across all these different texts, well, that gives you something really specific and interesting to look at this thematically, but it doesn't really give you a strong sense of what a particular text or tradition is doing, right? So there's there's something also lost in that. So we just have to be aware of what that book is and how we're reading it. But it's true, when it's assigned for like a teacher training or something, and like this is the primary text for your history or philosophy section, there's something that might be lost there for students. So on the one end, if you have a kind of very scholarly book like that, on the other hand, in terms of more popular books on yoga that are more accessible by the public, there hasn't really been anything, let's be honest, that is really very good or that holds up based on the more recent research or evidence that we have about yoga. So again, you know, I congratulate you, because I feel like the timing is really right for this, but you've also done something really unique here in taking, you know, rigorous academic studies, something we can kind of hold our hat on, even though it's changing and updating very quickly here. But you've taken sort of the state of the field. You obviously have a great command of having read, you know, and been very aware and even on the ground with some of that research at SOAS. But then it really is a very readable book, something that I think somebody without having to have too much background knowledge can kind of pick up and work their way through. And I think at the end of the day, if one read this book, they're not going to know everything, but they're going to have a really rich foundation for this and be able, I think, to then kind of go deeper into any of these specific areas or texts or traditions. Was that kind of your thinking as well?
Well, thank you, Seth. I'm glad to hear that. I mean, that was certainly my aspiration for writing it. And, you know, it's heartening to hear. And, you know, I'm honored that you think that, to be honest. You know, obviously, you're at the cutting edge of this field yourself. So, you know, I guess my slight concern when speaking to somebody, you know, who's in that position is that they'll see through it, because, you know, in the end, it's an overview, isn't it? And it can only scratch the surface. So I've done my best to summarize things as effectively as possible. But as soon as we generalize or summarize, then there's always the possibility of seeing the exception or, you know, picking holes effectively, and there's a value to that. And of course, that's how scholarly knowledge advances. As you say, the field doesn't stand still, because everybody is, you know, in a very sort of collegial way, you know, holding each other to account. And so all I've really tried to do is to provide a window on some of the knowledge that's come my way through that process. I mean, I start the acknowledgements by saying, you know, I couldn't have written it were it not for all these people doing this wonderful work. And I guess I just had this slight fear that some of that work wouldn't reach as wide an audience as I would like it to. And not to suggest that, you know, I'm the only person who can make that happen by any stretch of the imagination. I just felt that that's where I could contribute. That's the training I have. That's what I used to do. I used to be told at a moment's notice, go get a plane, go to some country where you don't speak the language and don't know anything, and somehow by tea time have something to tell the world, which is a terrifying thing. And obviously, you know, it reveals the ludicrous nature of the information systems that we rely on, because there's a lot of people who don't know that much, bluffing quite a lot. So in this case, you know, I'm not bluffing. I've done the hard work. I do know what I'm talking about. But at the same time, as soon as you get into that realm of trying to summarize, as I say, there are inevitable pitfalls. So as I say, I'm very happy that you feel that way. Thank you.
What do you think about what was behind the choice to not use diacritics for the Sanskrit word? I'd be
That's a
curious
good question.
to talk about that. I wonder, is that something you felt strongly about? Or was it a conversation with publishers? This is something I'm honestly just often thinking about in terms of, as you say, you know, making things accessible, but also finding this balance between accessibility and kind of the integrity of the traditions, let us say, wanting to educate but not sell short. And for me, you know, diacritics is something, I'll just say I feel strongly about using them. And I prefer to see them in publications because it helps to encourage better pronunciation, but also for people to be able to go and look up words. And without them, we often have all these variant spellings, and you know, words can kind of get more confused more easily. So I'm not accusing you of anything, but I'm just opening a conversation about to use them or not, pros and cons of those in a publication like this.
It's an excellent question, and I don't think there's a right answer, and I weighed it up, and my gut was on the side of not using them, because I think that they only make sense to people who've already got some knowledge of Sanskrit, and I'm trying to reach here for the, here we are at the start of Roots of Yoga, where they've got a passage on diacritics and explaining how they work. In fact, this one doesn't actually say that much. It just says that they use diacritics. Usually in a book, there's a sort of description of how you pronounce all these little signs. And unless someone's actually already had some exposure to what to do with that, it's just more information that goes in one part of the brain and out of the other. So I really felt like if my intention is to try and provide, you know, a way in, if the spelling is phonetic and simplified in as clear a way as possible, then hopefully people won't badly mispronounce words, and that's a start. But I'm totally with you. I mean, when I teach normally, all my slides, I use diacritics because I'm expecting that some people will A, have some knowledge already, B, want to plug these words into a dictionary, especially online, and look them up for themselves. And therefore they need the accurate spelling. There is a convention, and they're representing sounds that we don't have in the English language. So if you start collapsing, you know, the various sibilants into just SH, then you lose some nuance. They're different sounds made in different parts of the mouth. And obviously, you know, that's lost. But it just seems to me it's a question of priorities. And ultimately, my priority was to try and, you know, remove as many obstacles to people reading further as I possibly could. And the publisher had no input in it at all. It was a decision I made very early on. But as I went through the book, I kept reviewing it and thinking, I don't know about this, because as I say, when I'm teaching everywhere else, all my materials have got them in. So I often find myself, you know, going between whether it's slide decks I've prepared for a particular session on something, and then chapters I wrote in the book, and finding myself confounded by this disparity between the two.
Right, it gets a bit tricky because you have to be all in one way or another.
Exactly. And I'm generally all in for using diacritics. I just felt that this book in and of itself.
Fair enough, Daniel. I'm not accusing you. I think if the priority and the aim is to make it as accessible, as non-specialist as possible, then that totally makes sense. And having them might be another, you know, obstacle, antaraya, for your reader, might put them off, frankly.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, if it's something that doesn't make sense to you, then the eyes glaze over and they jump forwards a little bit to try and find somewhere else that they can settle on that feels a bit more familiar. That's my only feeling.
So you sounds like you were working on this for a few years, at least since I saw you in Boston. And you know, what was the writing process like for this? Are you, I imagine, because you have this background as a journalist, you've maybe created the writing practice, are you somebody who can kind of sit down and you say, okay, I'm going to write such and such, you know, X amount of words in this day or this many hours every day? Tell us a little bit about what the process was like.
I mean, in its own way, it's I guess it is a practice, writing. It's you have to show up every day and do some, and slowly things will change. Some days you go forward, some days a good day involves deleting some words. But in the past, I've approached other projects a little bit more systematically. There was a book I wrote, getting on for 10 years ago now, about my experiences as a journalist, which involved me going to the British Library every day, sitting there for 5-6 hours, writing. I had a target of 1,000 words each day. And, over a fairly short period of time, 3 or 4 months, I had a draft, and I took a month off, and then I did it again for another month and a half or so, and I'd edited it. And then I had a book, and then I couldn't find a publisher. And so I guess I was always mindful of that experience. I mean, I did in the end get it published, but it took me a year to find a publisher for that. And even in this case, I'd finished a draft of this within 6 months of when we met. It wasn't a very good draft, and it needed a lot of work done to it. But I always had that sense of, how much more time can I invest in this without being clear that it's ever going to see the light of day? And it's a mixture of confidence, but it's also a mixture of priorities and what one needs to do with one's time to make sure that all the other things like paying the bills happen. So I was teaching and was busy with that, so I would often work on it for a burst of time, for a few weeks, and then put it aside again. So that's one of the reasons it took longer. And actually, I mean, it was completed, I guess now it must be, it's almost 2 years ago. And then I got it accepted by North Point Press, Farris and Giroux, 18 months ago. And it's that's the lead time in the modern game of publishing. So over the last year and a half, I've had this feeling of, I hope it's still relevant. But thankfully, that being in the business of very serious New York publishing, we've been through several rounds of editing, and so I've had every opportunity to go back through. I'm sure there'll be a few things I've missed, but it's been good to see that it stands up, and also to have the chance to go back to it cold after 6 months and see a few things that need a bit more work, or that just need removing, need updating in some cases as well. So
in terms of the content of the book, again, we said it's very ambitious. It's wide ranging in terms of its sources. Let's just say we're going from the Vedas to Vinyasa, right? So I'm curious.
You have a course on that, Seth. It's a good title.
There's another book, if you haven't seen it, that's in your genre. You've seen that one? Yeah. It's very short. I haven't read it, so I can't really comment on it. But it's a great title. I like that title. I'm curious, reading, there's so much material that one needs to gain command of to write such a book, or to do it well, let's say. What were some of the biggest challenges, like in terms of what areas of yoga's history were the most challenging for you to write? Question one. And then two, were there any surprises or like genuine things that you learned that you did not know prior to doing the research that came out from this project?
That's an excellent question. I'll have to reflect on the second bit and go first to the first bit. I think really, I should also explain that, I teach these subjects at the Oxford Centre for Hindu Studies, the history and philosophy of yoga. And so over the last 4 or 5 years now, since I left SOAS, I've been immersing myself in this material as my day job. Obviously without the same structure that one has as a research student producing a piece of original work, which always takes one a little bit deeper and also becomes more specialist in its focus. I've instead been in this position of being a generalist, but at the same time, I have to deal with students from all over the world who ask me pretty probing questions. So a lot of my job is to respond to student queries on the spot. And that's shifted this year from being a thing that's moderated over a forum to being live online on Zoom, people put me on the spot. So my yoga library has grown, and the amount of time I spend furrowing through books in search of answers is increased. And that's part of how the book took shape in a way. I became clear very early on in doing that work with the OCHS, which started in 2016, that what I was doing as a sort of facilitator of these conversations was very similar to what I was doing teaching, you know, on yoga teacher training programs, was trying to provide succinct summaries of very complicated things that really deserved whole books, and instead they were going to get distilled into 200 words. And I realized actually that was of great value. So I slowly went about trying to do that for all of the things that were on the tip of my tongue, and then over the course of time had to expand. And for me, the area that, you know, I just don't have as much knowledge of is the tantric traditions. And I've had the good fortune through my time at the Oxford Centre for Hindu Studies to attend some lectures by, you know, real experts, Gavin Flood, Alexis Sanderson, and through that have been able to deepen my reading. But you know, those are things that I hadn't really studied for myself before I came into the world of yoga scholarship. And I've always felt a little bit daunted by, I suppose, because they're vast. And yeah, you look at roots of yoga, and to go back to what you were saying earlier, when there are these extracts from texts we don't necessarily understand the context for, often those are from tantric texts where there are these practices that address some of the disciplines that have become part of yoga traditions, but they may be, you know, presented in other ways and as part of a broader picture that, you know, is articulated as you go through the book, and you can see how it all fits together. But that was something before I read Roots of Yoga, I realized I'm pretty blind on, to be honest. I'm aware of the influence on Hatha Yoga from, you know, tantric practices, but I haven't read any of these texts originally for myself. That was my original feeling. So I spent time trying to do that. You know, obviously some of these sources that have been, you know, texts that have formed part of Roots of Yoga, the translations of some of those tantric texts come from other scholars, and their work is available, and having the good fortune to be near Oxford, I can go into the library and read it. So I've tried to do that and try and get a better handle on it, but there's only so much one can learn in a short space of time, and I really am aware that that's, you know, thankfully I've only really addressed Tantra from the point of view of its influence on physical yoga practice, but obviously it's an ever expanding field, and over the last few years, as Jim Mallinson has explained in his course for you, I think there's a lot been discovered about these sort of interactions between different tantric traditions, even to the extent that the idea of his research has been turned on its head by discovering various Buddhist influences that were not known to him some years ago when he was first setting out to really survey this field of early Hatha Yoga texts. So, you know, there's a lot there, and I'm sure there's more that hasn't yet been uncovered or pieced together quite as it might be. So I'm aware that that's where I'm flying blind.
And fair enough. I mean, the world of Tantra is incredibly vast and complex, and we have a very, you know, oftentimes in public perception, often like yoga itself with Tantra, a very simplified and superficial understanding of what Tantra is as tantric sex or something. But anybody who's actually trying to understand, you know, pre-modern Tantra in the Indian traditions, all one has to do is look at, you know, Alexis Sanderson's 1988 article that tried to map this out, at least in the world of Shaivism, Shaiva Tantra, Shaivism and the tantric traditions, just to kind of get a sense of the complexity of the webs of different strands and streams of Shaiva Tantra and the sheer amount of literature and texts. Very difficult to generalize what all of those different traditions are seeking to do and how yoga fits into that. It's indeed a really vast topic. So if you're not a specialist in that field, it's definitely something that takes, I think, years and years actually to get a hold of, just even the terminology that those traditions are using.
Absolutely. And I think, again, you know, I mean, that's one of these areas, a lot of people are interested in Tantra. I mean, it's got, you know, this cachet in popular culture, and also even, you know, in the yoga teacher world of, there's something sexy about it in a different way. It, you know, somehow it's this idea of, sort of, well, the particularly the non-dual flavor of it has really inspired a lot of people to see something, you know, very kind of accessible and immediate and life affirming, I suppose. And so there are various distilled versions of that that have become quite popular. And I've read some brutal reviews that Alexis Anderson has written of some works that have tried to popularize things. And again, you know, I suppose that's why I felt like I really need to be on on the best behavior with this material, because it's tricky. And a lot of things that we think we know, we don't necessarily know. And a lot of those texts are written in code anyway, and they're not really designed to be the manual that's all secret and told to you by the guru in any case.
Yeah. So were there anything that comes to mind, we can come back to it later or scrap it, but was there anything that surprised you? Maybe whether it's something you thought you had a clear understanding about and something you realized, well, maybe that's a little bit different, or just perhaps something new, something that clarified itself in the process of researching this book.
There really is something, and, you know, it's a little awkward to talk about it in a way, because, you know, I don't want to disparage any scholars in the process, but...
Please go ahead.
I do feel, I mean, you know, this seminal text, Yoga Body, that brought both of us into the realm of studying yoga academically, very influential, really, really, really eye-opening, and very engaging. And I guess it led me to, on a certain level, this false conclusion that Mark Singleton is understandably irked that people jump to, that there's something inherently inauthentic about modern yoga, and that... many of the fusions that created it owed very little to Indian tradition. And his book does make it pretty hard not to jump to that conclusion. Let's put it that way. And obviously, you know, that's not what he's saying. He's talking about the context in which something took place. But I guess I was surprised to find myself falling back in love with modern postural yoga in a weird kind of a way, and wanting to articulate the ways in which there is some integrity to how some of those inventions were put together. And as I say, I don't in any way wish to criticize what Mark did. I guess all I was really trying to say was that I felt it was sometimes the case in scholarly writing about modern yoga that the critical analysis leaves little space for celebration of its power. And a lot of the people who are doing the work are practitioners. And it was really heartening to hear your conversation with Mark recently, in which you talked about this and talked about his background as a yoga teacher. And again, I don't want to talk about what he was doing. It's more just having imbibed a lot of that. Well,
I think what you're saying is important. So I'm glad we're going there.
Everybody always tells me, you know, when I discuss this stuff with them, that, you know, I'm making them fall out of love with yoga, and I'm really trying to tell them that's not the aim, for one, and for two, the ultimate authenticity is our relationship with what we do, and if we want it, a relationship with the tradition. But it's not even compulsory to have that, although I do think it's, you know, a question we should all raise for ourselves. If we're going to call what we do yoga, it ought to have some connection to other things that have been called yoga otherwise. It's self-serving branding, perhaps. But I think a lot of these modern postural hybrids have that. And it's always been interesting to me to try and articulate what those connection points are. And I'm not sure I necessarily did that overtly in the chapters I wrote about modern yoga, but I think some of that came through because one of the people who was kind enough to read an early copy and provide a comment on it, Anya Foxen, who's written a couple of books about modern yoga, commented on it was part of an attempt to take modern yoga seriously. And I think that's really, as a practitioner of modern postural yoga who's found it enormously beneficial, feel it's important to encourage people to find their own connections to sources of authenticity, both within themselves and within the Indian traditions. And so I guess it was the conclusion that surprised me. I found myself having one that admitted to myself and to anyone who reads the book that A, I'm not enlightened, B, I don't know everything, and see that doesn't matter, because it's all about, you know, trying to be honest with ourselves. That's the whole point of writing this book. That's why it's got truth in the title. I care passionately about truth, and that's why I stopped being a journalist in a context that I was felt was corrupted. It's why I've done my best to try and represent what other people have done as faithfully as I can, you know, in a format that I hope is accessible. But you know, ultimately, we've all got to do that for ourselves. We've all got to engage with this material and come away with something that makes sense to us. And that will involve reinterpreting things, and it will involve, you know, I guess, ultimately reinventing things. And so long as we're honest about doing that, that's totally okay. The problems start to creep in when people sort of elide that. And I guess, you know, coming full circle, that's part of what, you know, inspired Bark Singleton's work initially, was trying to show some of the self-serving stories that have been told about the birth of these innovations as if they were actually continuations of ancient history, weren't true. And because the people who done that, like Krishnamacharya, weren't open about that process, although there are little hints scattered around his oeuvre where it's hard to miss. It has to be picked to pieces. And I guess, you know, as I say, I felt happy in myself and more able to present this to teachers and students as I became clearer in the sense that there are ways in which one can find these connections, not only for oneself, but in what those guys were doing. And I suppose, yeah, again, you know, I feel uncomfortable. I don't want to suggest that there's something missing from what Mark did. It's just that I do wonder if he was writing that book from scratch now, if it would look the same way.
It's a fair question. I sort of asked him, maybe not as clearly as I could have, you know, what kind of things maybe hold up or would you change kind of with the onslaught really of research that's happened and taken place since then. And I don't think any book like that would be the same. I think any scholar, just like any artist or painter or something, like, you know, is going to continue to change their work as one goes. I'm sure you've experienced that with your book. I mean, every time you post a Word doc, you're gonna continue to fidget with it, right? Until you just at some point say, "Okay, I'm done," and you're gonna.
So someone has to wrench it out of your hands in the end. It's a bit like, you know, sort of with submitting a dissertation. If you could sit on it forever, then it would you'd never get your PhD.
Deadlines are important. I do think, you know, okay, to Mark's credit, in the Yoga Body, you know, he does at several points, especially in the conclusion, say this study, by showing this unique historical confluence and context of these global physical cultural forces, by no means is meant to delegitimize the authenticity or even spiritual and religious power of modern yoga. He does say that. And so I always want to point to that. Nonetheless, I do agree with you that regardless of however many times he says that.
Compare that to the line in the introduction where he says there's absolutely no connection between Indian traditional Hatha yoga and modern expressions of postural yoga. So it's,
right. And I think one.
Jar with one another, those two bits.
One, going through the journey of reading that book, if you're a yoga teacher who had certain conceptions about the antiquity, let's say, you know, or where, you know, the connections to India of this practice, in many ways, for a lot of readers, those connections and those narratives are sort of severed by the end. And there is often a feeling of disenchantment that one goes through, and a kind of, well, where do I turn next? And how, what am I doing? A re-questioning. I think so many people have experienced that on many different levels. It's one reason I'm excited, not to plug Mark's online course, but we've got him coming on, and it's going to be a way to really think with him about where he's at now with the work he's been doing since Yoga Body and what he's doing of kind of looking at yoga moving forward. Because I do think some of his views have changed. Some of them remain the same.
Well, absolutely. And I think that came out in your conversation with him. That's the only reason I made the comment. You know, it would be, obviously, you know, he's defending his work, quite rightly so. It's admirable. I mean, it's everybody ends up acknowledging. I mean, it's a really landmark piece of work that is unignorable. It's a cornerstone of modern yoga studies. And it's stood the test of time. It's a PhD turned into a book that ordinary people read. That's an achievement in itself.
But what I'd like to say, though, and this kind of just gets back to your book and your work, is that, you know, this, I think when one approaches the history of yoga seriously in this manner, they can either come away feeling like, you know, okay, everything I thought I knew is wrong, this kind of Mythbusters approach of like, you know, there's this debunking everything I thought was sacred and ancient and holy and this sort of thing. There is no truth of yoga, right? There is no single yoga tracing back to the Vedas, that sort of thing. I mean, I guess if somebody really had, you know, a very strong sense of that about the yoga that they were doing and it and in those connections, that can be very undergirding. It can be dismantling of their sense of self and practice. But I think on the flip side, another thing that happens often, and in my experience when sharing this knowledge and teachings with people, is that there's actually, as you said, there's actually an infusing of joy and inspiration. There's kind of an empowerment with studying this history because you realize actually yoga is so much more multifaceted and plural, and there's so much more room actually for innovation and expressions of yoga to come through. But my question for you, though, is there's also, because I think there's also some danger in that relativism of yoga. So my question to you then is, you know, if somebody reads this book, The Truth of Yoga, and they say, well, Daniel, you say there is no truth of yoga. Yoga has been so many things, anything under the sun. So whatever I want, I can just call it yoga. Anything can be yoga.
Well, they actually say at one point, you know, things don't become yoga just because somebody says that they are. But sorry, I cut you off.
No, I was done. Just to put it to you, you know, what is your? I'm sure you get those questions when you're teaching at Oxford or in teacher trainings. What is kind of your response when people say, well, then, you know, if there is no truth to yoga, you know, then I can just do whatever I want and I can call anything yoga. You know, kind of how do you respond to students like that?
Well, I think, as I say, there are clear common factors. If we're talking about physical practice traditions, you know, starting at the very beginning, you know, yoga was articulated as a meditation practice, turning inward and focusing inward. So concentration and internalization just seem to be consistently themes in the way that yoga is presented in early texts. And unless something is really geared in that direction, I don't know how much it has to do with yoga tradition, if I'm entirely honest. And so one can question if a lot of things currently presented today are facilitating that. I mean, some people find it, you know, very grounding and internalizing to be able to tune out of their mind and into a music soundtrack. I personally don't find that, but you know, that's not to say that the playing of music is inherently un-yogic. I mean, it's impossible to actually come up with this sort of where the line is, but I think we are all able to see for ourselves that there has to be a line somewhere, that not everything can count as yoga. And in the end, what really matters, I think, is less about pointing the finger at other people and saying, well, they're not doing yoga. It's more about, you know, having an honest relationship with ourselves about what we're doing, as to why are we calling it yoga? What is yoga? What is yoga for me? Why am I interested in this stuff? Why am I not interested in, you know, running on the treadmill or drinking 10 beers? You know, what is it that I'm actually trying to do here? And so there is some process of cultivating stillness through some way of disengaging with, you know, this flurry of information through the mind and the senses, that doesn't necessarily mean disengaging from life. And obviously that's really where we're onto, you know, the open territory, I suppose. This is why I always wanted to study academically, but it's not really academic study, it's theology at this stage. It's to try and say, you know, what does all this mean in the 21st century when we're not renunciates? There aren't many yoga texts that do what the Bhagavad Gita does and starts talking about, you know, living in the world and being socially engaged and doing just a little bit of this stuff to top up on the ability to act with less attachment. And so if that's what most people are turning to yoga practice for in the 21st century, just to tune out a little bit, Is there perhaps some new configuration of, another sort of yoga Upanishad for the 21st century that still needs to be written? And I often feel that there is, but I've come more to the conclusion that we all have to write our own. And so I guess that's all I'm really building up to, is that question is for each of us a very personal one, I think, and it's not really possible to generalize.
Well, it sounds like you've got your next book project.
Maybe.
You heard it here first, right, on the Yoga Studies podcast. Yoga Upanishad for the 21st century. It is interesting. It is interesting to think, though, about, if we're honest about the history, and it's one of constant evolution and innovation and adaptation. And we can put in brackets traditional yoga if it's sort of within an Indian context and maybe even pre-colonial and these sort of things. But where do those lines, end? At what point does yogic innovation become non-traditional? And those are subtle and open-ended questions, I think, because yoga is changing in radical ways today.
Well, absolutely. Some of those things that Mark discussed in your podcast, and that will be obviously a feature of his course, talking about technology and if you can just push a button to silence your mind, is that yoga, or is that some sort of full frontal lobotomy by digital means? It's a really interesting question. I think there's something about this sort of engagement with ourselves that's fundamental to how yoga has been expressed and the way we relate to the world through ourselves. And that goes really back to the earliest Upanishads. And whether or not it's been called yoga, it's informed most expressions of yoga that have identified themselves as such. And there's new ways in which people are seeking to do that. And where it goes from here is kind of up to us. I suppose that's really why I wrote the book, is to say, if you're engaged with yoga in the 21st century and you're freestyling, as we're all inevitably going to a certain extent, it helps to have some idea of what's gone before. And if you're interested in trying to align in some way with previous tradition, then here's a whole bunch of thematic material that you might dip into and see how to do that. And also to see ways in which that's being misrepresented right now, being distorted out of all meaning. And so, obviously there's enormous value, as coming back to in this critical project, of pointing out where things don't add up. And I guess all I was really building up to saying when talking about yoga body and as how things have moved on is just, with sort of a bigger picture perspective, sometimes can see that many things can be contained within this definition of yoga. And as Mark wrote in one of his other updates to this introduction, he wrote to a Serbian translation, both doesn't mean that yoga is nowhere because there are all these distinctions, or that anything can be yoga because somebody decides it is. There is a tradition. It may take many different forms, but it seems clear that some things fall outside of it. And the one example I often reach for is, for me, certainly in my idea of how it would be of any benefit, beer yoga. I like beer. I'm not very good at drinking it anymore. I don't have much tolerance for it. Certainly having a couple of beers and then trying to do something involving inward focused concentration, not so likely to happen. Having a laugh, maybe. But I wouldn't say having fun and drinking beer is yoga. Yoga is something else, I think. So having that as an adjunct to practicing yoga doesn't seem to me to have a great deal to do with the yoga tradition. And then again, you can go and find a bunch of Bengali tantrics getting smashed out their skulls sitting around a fire. So I have no idea what to say. In some ways, it's very hard to draw that line, but I think it's an important question to ask ourselves.
That's right. I'm thinking of Sufi poets and their wine, the mm-hmm. Chinese poets and their
absolutely
and their alcohol. And
we, to come back to where we started with my own slightly sort of awkward admission to having enjoyed chuffing on the hash pipe a little too much at one stage in my life, obviously that's there, that's part of the yoga tradition.
That reminds me of David Gordon White's opening in one of his books. I can't remember if it's Alchemical Body, but he says something like, I want to thank the knot yogis that I interviewed for their time, their wisdom, and their chillums, usually in that order or something like that.
Well, I don't know. I mean, I guess to come back to where we started, I think that was the problem. I sort of thought it was the other way around. I had some idea that if I could just sit around and get high enough, I might get enlightened. Whereas I realized in hindsight that was it, well, it wasn't working that way for me, at least.
Well, Daniel, I thank you for your time, your wisdom, and your microphone today.
Thank you, Seth. It's been a pleasure to chat.
It's been a pleasure. Where can folks find you? Where can they find the book?
Well, book will be on sale everywhere. You can find a website devoted to it, truthofyoga.com. I also teach online courses at the Oxford Centre for Hindu Studies. You can find them at ochsonline.org. And then there's my website, danielsimpson.info, where I also host other online gatherings, workshops, courses as well. So,
and do you have anything coming up you'd like to promote?
Well, I'll be putting together a course to accompany the book, which I'll be announcing in a few weeks' time, hopefully, if it all comes together as planned, just to try and, I guess, put it all into a bit of a broader context. So, if anyone's interested in that, you can either sign up for my newsletter or follow me on social media, and you'll find those links on my website.
Very good. All right. Well, thank you so much, Daniel. Again, congrats on the book. I look forward to being in touch.
Likewise, yeah, and wish you all the best and a happier 2021 for us all.
Yes, let's hope so. All right, take care.
Okay, you too. Bye-bye.
Thanks for listening to the Yogic Studies podcast. If you've enjoyed this episode, please consider leaving us a review on iTunes or sharing this episode with someone else. Thanks so much, everyone. Until next time, please take care.